will call the meeting of the Children and Family Finance and Policy Committee to order. And there is indeed a quorum present. Do I have a motion for the minutes for February 18th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Hansen wins yet again and moves the minutes of February 18th. Could I get a motion for, my mic was off. I call the Children and Families Committee to order. Vice Chair Hansen, do you have a motion?
I'd like to move approval of the minutes, Mr. Chair.
There we go. Vice Chair Hansen moves approval of the minutes for February 18th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So today we are hearing from DHS on their child care licensing standards. There is a lot of work to go through here that we'll be dealing with throughout this committee's work. And it will definitely be a heavy lift given the gravity of the situation. Given recent events, so I'm assuming, my daughter had a situation at a daycare. So it is my goal to give parents a voice at all times when they're in the same situation, because I feel so lucky to be where I am when my daughter has faced what she's faced and we can actually make a difference as a committee. I got connected with the parent, one of the child on video at Little Explorers Plymouth Academy. So prior to DHS presenting, I just offered them just a time to address the committee, because so many parents face so many troubles and they don't have an avenue to do anything about it. And the least we can do is, when we can, give them an opportunity. So I'll invite him to give a short testimony just to kick us off. And that will really frame my what I'm looking for from this Department of Human Services daycare license, child care licensing conversation about abuse and other things, among just running a child care center in general. So I'd like to invite Josh Truax up to the testimony table. And if you could introduce yourself for the record and give your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Joshua Truax. Good afternoon, Children and Families Committee. Who am I? Why am I here? And why should you care? My name is Joshua Truax. That's the who. For those of you who don't know, my son went viral 13 days ago because he was innocently drumming in the corner, having his own dance party, but was then told by the preschool teacher that she was sick of him, picked him up, slammed him into a chair, aggressively pushed him into a table, and while in that chair, had his drumsticks ripped from his hands and toys slammed down in his face. That was one of the videos. I am here today, not only just in grief and outrage, but with a shared commitment to not only justice, but also accountability and change. A place that should have been a sanctuary for young children became a scene of an unthinkable act. A defenseless, literally just turned 3-year-old a week prior, was subjected to emotional abuse, physically manhandled, while 19 other innocent children, only 2 and 3-year-olds themselves, were forced to witness. This was not just an isolated incident on one child. It was an act of deep and lasting harm against every single child in that room. Just another day in preschool A. The trauma inflicted upon these young minds is immeasurable. What should have been a place of laughter, learning, and safety turned into a nightmare. The emotional scars left by this jarring event will not fade easily. No child, no family should ever have to endure such egregious treatment. We should have more answers than questions, and most importantly, we should have change. To every parent, guardian, and concerned citizen, we need to stand together. We must demand stricter oversight, stronger protections, and real consequences for those who fail our children. No loopholes, no excuses, no indifference can be allowed to put another child at risk. To other families affected, you are not alone. We stand with you, we grieve with you, we fight alongside of you. These children deserve healing, justice, and a future where their emotional and physical safety is never in question. That's the why. This is our moment to make a difference. We cannot be silent. We cannot look away. We cannot stop until every child is safe. That's also the why. Let's make lasting changes so I can feel comfortable sending my son anywhere and sending any child anywhere. Where parents can feel comfortable sending their child, sorry, I lost where I was, to be overall 1% better than we were the day before and keep building upon that. What we can do to prevent this from happening and what you can take away from this to help my family and every other Minnesotan family. That's the why you should care. Thank you for listening and thank you for having me here today.
Thank you, Mr. Truex. Thank you, Mr. Truex. I think that's a good way to center our discussion today. I'll now invite the Department of Human Services up to give their child care licensing overview. It's a big factor we'll have to deal with in committee. And especially given the modernization movement as well. Now, we're going to have a separate day for that, but as it's relevant, feel free to add that into the committee today. But without further ado, please introduce yourself for the record, whoever will begin, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee. Thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Alyssa Dotson, and I am the Deputy Inspector General for the Licensing Division, which is part of the Office of Inspector General at DHS. I need 1 minute to get my slides set up here, and then I will jump right in. Okay. Thank you again for having us here at the committee to talk a little bit about child care and our licensing regulations, our enforcement mechanisms. I will also share a little bit about our regulation modernization project and the status of that today, and then a few questions about our program integrity area and our background studies we will cover today as well. So first I'm going to talk just a little bit about some general kind of licensing, kind of what's the grounding of licensing, what we do in the licensing division. The licensing division, we work in partnership with other people, with counties, with private agencies to license and certify a variety of programs for children and vulnerable adults. So more than just child care. We also do adult daycare, foster care for both children and adults, a range of disability services under our home and community-based services program. Mental health services, both outpatient and residential and substance use treatment. So there's a lot that kind of goes on in the division around those different programs. In general, the baseline of what we do in licensing is to ensure that programs can meet a minimum level of health and safety standards to ensure the well-being of children and vulnerable adults in care. We do this through monitoring, regular monitoring of the standards that are in place for each of those different program types. Kind of at a high level, some of these categories that these requirements cover are health and safety things, supervision, capacity, ratios of teacher to children that might be required, group sizes, how many children can be in each group, the physical space requirements where the services are being provided, whether that is in an individual's own home or whether it's more in a center or an outside facility-based program, training for the staff that are being providing these services or the license holders. There's some important in our children's services around infant safe sleep and protections to make sure that children are safe. And then there's background studies components to this as well. So it's kind of that 30,000 view of like there's multiple different categories under each of those, but that's just that broad high-level view to start with. So talking a little bit more specific just in childcare, for childcare licensing here, wanted to start by who needs a license. This question comes up a bit And people will ask, if I'm taking care of my neighbor's kids, do I need a license? How do I do this? The law says that if you intend to care for children for more than one unrelated family, then you do require a license in there. And in Minnesota, we have two different models of licensing. We have our center-based programs and then our family child care-based programs. These are licensed according to Minnesota statutes, but then there's also additional regulations in the rules that are specific to those programs and how they operate on top of just kind of the baseline general licensing statute. Our child care centers are those out-of-home programs that are caring for larger numbers of children. Typically, the children are separated by age group. You might have an infant classroom, a preschool classroom, school-age classroom, and then specific ratios that are needed to be met for each of those different classrooms and teachers who are in those programs. And then our family child care programs are programs that are provided mostly out of the license holder's own home. These are smaller programs. Right now, the no more than 14 children can be cared for at a time. And these are mixed age groups, so they don't have to have children isolated by age group in their own home. They're mixed age groups with different ratios that are allowed for each of those. We also have child care certification that you might hear about. A certified program is actually a program that meets a license exemption. Typically, these are our school age programs. And so in statute, it calls out who needs a license and who's exempt from a license. So these programs would be exempt from licensure. However, if they want to accept funding from the Child Care Assistance Program or CCAP, that subsidy program, then they need to meet minimum levels of health and safety requirements. And so we certify these programs to those minimum health and safety requirements so that they can accept that CCAP funding. We have approximately 620 certified programs right now. Like I said, most of these are going to be our school-age programs. The school-age programs that are run at the YMCA or YWCA, the JCC, in some of the public schools, after-school programs, things like that. And so those would meet, again, a license exemption, but they're taking that CCAP funding, so there's a required minimum level of that health and safety that they need to meet. You'll also hear us talk about our delegated licensing system. We have, again, kind of two ways that licensing is conducted here in the state of Minnesota. We have our directly licensed and our delegated licensing. So those are the programs that the counties actually oversee and have the primary responsibility for the licensing functions here. Family child care is one of those programs that does have a delegated licensing, and I'll get into some of those details here in a second. But there's also additional programs in licensing that have that same delegated structure. That would be for our child foster care, adult foster care, and some of our family adult day services. Mostly these are going to be programs that are operated out of a person's own home, some of those smaller programs there. The counties do have a small part in some of our disability programs where they inspect the physical plant for community residential settings, which are more commonly referred to as a group home. They're a four-person home for individuals with disabilities in the community. And then we have 22 private agencies that also monitor child foster care licensing as permitted under statute. So I mentioned a little bit that our family child care programs are delegated to the county. Our child care centers are what we call directly licensed programs, where they are licensed. Our licensing is conducted from the state level at that from Department of Human Services. So just to kind of cover a few of the differences in how this process works, for child care centers, the licenses are issued directly by DHS. For family child care programs, the county processes that initial application paperwork, works with an applicant on meeting the requirements that they might need for licensure, and then they recommend to DHS whether that license should be approved or granted, or whether it should be denied and for what reasons. We have a team here at DHS that will review those recommendations and then issue those actions from there. For child care centers and those directly licensed programs, the DHS licensors are the ones that go out and conduct that routine monitoring and the visits and the to go out on site and do the inspections. And for the delegated system in family child care, the county licensors are the ones that go out and conduct those inspections and visits from there. For centers, we at DHS can issue those licensing actions based on the inspections that those DHS licensors do and any results that need to come from that. And then from the family child care world, those, again, those are recommendations that are made to DHS. So the county licensors do the inspection work. And then if there is anything that, other than a correction order, any kind of licensing sanction that would be issued, whether it be a conditional license or a fine, something of that, then they would recommend to DHS that they would want to take this action, and DHS refuse that and issues the sanction out of DHS. And at the bottom of this slide, there's just some updated numbers that we have as of February 2025. I know that all of us are paying close attention to these numbers and the trends here, and I'll talk a little bit about trends in a second, too. But as of February, earlier this month, there were 1,791 licensed centers and 5,756 licensed family child care providers. On that same line of our county delegated system, wanted to highlight that in February of 2024, so a year ago, the Office of Legislative Auditor released a report. They had been auditing our DHS's support to the county agencies in there. And they released their report about a year ago. And the findings in general were fairly positive in that the licensors agreed DHS were providing effective support to them. They had favorable opinions of our communication and licensing requirements, and that said that we had made consistent efforts to inform and engage county licensors when there were changes implemented. But as always, there's always room for improvement, and we recognize that, and we are committed to continuing to learn and grow and do better. Some of the areas that they called out that were recommendations for us to continue to improve on was being able to provide written guidance to that was easily accessible to all county licensors. This was related to some of the trainings that we do for county licensors or some of the monthly meetings that we do for them. Not all of our materials are accessible, and we don't have a succinct, easy way to post that information onto the website right now. We are working towards compliance with accessibility standards and some systems and some resource limitations that we have right now to be able to do that, but welcomed that recommendation, and I believe that that is a goal that we have to be able to continue to provide that more education and information to those licensors. And then also just kind of shoring up some of our processes for these licensing action recommendations across all of our delegated programs. So that's the foster care programs as well as family child care, making sure that we have consistent timelines, consistent processes within those timelines as well. And so we actually currently have a project ongoing right now to evaluate that because we don't want to just pick a timeline and stick with it without identifying what are the barriers or why we're not able to meet that timeline right now. So we're evaluating that process right now so that we can eliminate and remove those barriers and figure out what is needed to get to a consistent place of timelines for those county programs. So I'd mentioned the trends, and I know that that's top of mind for a lot of us here. We've seen some of these trends and the decrease in numbers of providers. As it has happened, it is a national trend. Minnesota's trend is on par with some of what we have seen nationally, and this actually, we saw kind of a peak of the number of programs nationally in like 2002. So this has been happening on the decrease for quite a while now. I think there's probably a lot of factors that contribute to that and no kind of one magic answer, and we have been working with closely with our partners at DCYF as well to evaluate, you know, what is contributing to these, how can we encourage providers to come into the field, how can we maintain the current providers that we have, and what more can we do for capacity building. And I know that our partners at DCYF right now are doing quite a bit in that space as well, so we're continuing and dedicated to working towards that. You know, none of us want to see these declining numbers and families losing access to childcare or providers not being able to stay in business. And so we want to work with them to see what we can do and all of you to support that. One thing I did want to highlight that a few years ago, we had worked with Wilder Research to conduct a study, or they conducted a study to explore alternate licensing models. And so they looked at what are other states doing and really kind of looked at our close by states that are pretty similar in comparison to our population and what those models might be in there. And is there a different way to support these smaller programs and not, you know, continue to just build capacity in childcare centers, but we've got some of these smaller desire for smaller programs that may not just be in a provider's own home. Is there a way to explore that? Some other states do offer small center or group childcare license for medium-sized programs. And one of the key differences here when we're talking about those small centers versus kind of the bigger centers is whether they are mixed age groups or they are kind of those separated age groups as well, like we see in our traditional centers right now. But having a small center or other models that might be able to take on some of that desire from smaller programs wanting to have this, but for a variety of reasons may not be able to or desire to operate it out of their own home. So we do have that report and definitely interested in engaging around that and continuing to explore just across the board how we can support this and continue to build capacity in this area. And then I wanted to highlight here, as you've noticed, I am with the Department of Human Services and still here, the Office of Inspector General Programs are still here at DHS. And this June, some of our licensing functions that support children will be transferring to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. So that includes our DHS units that support family child care licensing and child care foster licensing. It includes our child care center and child care certification teams. And that private, the support for those private child placing agencies. This does not change the county delegated system. So those licensors that are employed by the counties and doing the work in there, they will remain with the counties and continue to do that work. It is our DHS staff that are transferring from DHS to DCYF this coming June. Okay, next. I'm going to talk a little bit about our kind of enforcement and inspection processes here. First thing to kind of call out is that there are some federal requirements that we are required to be in compliance with under the Child Care and Development Fund, CCDF. You might hear us talk about this interchangeably as CCDBGA, the Child Care Development Block Grant, and the Child Care Development Fund. They are related. One is the enacting legislation, one is the fund, but these terms get thrown around interchangeably in this. So this program sets out what the requirements are for licensed child care and programs and license exempt programs. Covers some of those high-level categories that I mentioned before, background studies, health and safety requirements. There's requirements in there about how programs need to be inspected, how often, and what types of inspections they need to have, and also what types of consumer education needs to be put out there for families and programs as well. So then this Minnesota and all the other states that are part of this program, then we look at what those federal requirements are in those categories, and then we establish standards with the legislature here to comply with what those requirements are. So licensing inspections. The CCDF, the federal plan, does require that licensors conduct annual unannounced visits to child care programs. And so these are not, we're not calling the provider saying, hey, I'll be there Tuesday and coming out. They are unannounced visits. And we do these at a variety of time of the day to respond to when programs might be operating. If we know a program is operating in the afternoon and evenings, our licensors will go out in the afternoon or evening. And if we also try to vary these in the calendar year as well, because things happen differently in the winter than they do in the summer, whether there's access to outdoor equipment or playgrounds or how they're doing that in the winter. So both want to just kind of see how programs are operating in the different seasons, but also an opportunity for providers to kind of share the good and exciting things that they're doing around some of those things at different times as well. When licensors go out and do these annual reviews, things that they're looking at, they're doing a tour of that licensed space, kind of looking at, is it in good repair? Are there any obvious, disrepair that could pose a danger? Is it in line with the space that they said that was agreed upon for their license and this is how they're licensed? And yep, it looks like that's all in line. They're also reviewing policies and procedures, records, both the child records and staff records for compliance with what is needed to be gathered for that and for personnel records for training and things like that. So they're kind of doing a comprehensive review of both the paperwork and the physical space and just observing how care is provided as well, and may do some interviews with staff too. We also have what we call our early and often unit. So this was developed in 2019 from funding from the legislature, and it was in response to another OLA audit around the CCAP fraud that was occurring. So this unit is kind of exactly what it's described at, early and often. We want to get out to providers early when they first become licensed, and we want to visit them often. And so new centers, and this is just for center-based right now, it is not for family childcare. But new centers would get four visits from their licensor within that first year. The first visit is announced, and it's focused on technical assistance. And so that is shortly after they become licensed, having a licensor come out and say, okay, now that you're operating, what questions have come up? Let me take a look at what's going on. Let me give you some technical assistance on how you can come into compliance or point out areas that might be out of compliance and really try to help them along in that process. And then they do three additional unannounced visits during that year. And in the third quarter, they actually partner with early and often investigator from our program integrity division as well, who goes out, and that's where they can provide some of that assistance and education and technical assistance around things that often become indicators of fraud, attendance records and children's records and things like that, to say, here's how you need to be in compliance with this so that you're not accidentally in a space that might result in something that looks like fraud. Here's what the requirements are. And really trying to provide that education up front to providers so that they know what they need to do to be into compliance here. And we've received a lot of really positive feedback from providers around this program, saying that it's been immensely helpful for them, and other providers who have been long-term that have said, hey, why can't you come out and do that for me too in there? And so this has been one of our more successful programs to be able to provide some extra assistance to providers. So in any of our visits, if we do identify non-compliance, there's a number of different ways that we can address this. If they're out of compliance with any of the standards, we always look at the nature, severity, and chronicity of the violation. So we want to know, you know, what type of violation was it? Did it impact the health and safety of the children? Is this a kind of chronic violation that we have seen repeat happen before and hasn't been addressed? We're always kind of looking at those things. And then we have a range of options of ways that we can come in with enforcement tools to bring providers up to compliance here. The next couple slides, we'll get into a few more details of these, but these go from a correction order or what we call a fix-it ticket to anything towards a fine or a conditional or a sanction against a provider's license. For any of the actions that we take from correction orders on up, they can either request reconsideration of that violation or for licensing sanctions such as a revocation or a fine, they can appeal that to a judge as well and go through kind of, they have their due process of each of those. So the next couple slides go through what these enforcement tools are and kind of a tiered process of how we do this. So the lowest level that we see of these enforcement tools are what we call fix-it tickets. This was enacted in statute several years ago. There's a set list of violations that are violations that do not imminently endanger the health and safety and rights of children. They are things that can be corrected in short order. The provider has 48 hours to correct it, not including weekends and holidays. And it's a set list that's determined by the commissioner. So these can be things like if a licensor is out on site and they tour the bathroom and they see that there's no soap or hand towels in the bathroom and the provider's like, oh, I have it in the storage closet. Let me go, you know, fill it. I'll get that done. That could be a fix-it ticket. That is a violation. You need to make sure that we have sanitary equipment available. But it's not something that imminently has endangered the children. We also then document those because if there is a repeat violation, somebody is not going to continue to get a fix-it ticket for something that is a repeat violation. So we track the chronicity of those. Correction orders are the next level up. These are orders that would outline kind of what the violation is, what the licensor observed that, or what the statute is, what the actual requirement is, what the licensor observed, and then what the provider might need to do to come into compliance with that. These, again, aren't going to be things that are just imminently endangering the health and safety, but they are things that are maybe take a little bit longer to fix. They're not things that could be fixed in that short order of that 48 hours. And so the provider would get a correction order for that. And they have, again, due process rights with those. They can appeal or request reconsideration of those, where our legal team would review for accuracy of those violations. We have fines that can be issued. These are for licensing violations that would impact the health and safety of children, including child maltreatment. So a fine for maltreatment can either be $1,000 or $5,000, depending on the severity of the fine. For family child care providers, it is always $1,000. That has been carved out in statute for those smaller providers. But for centers, depending on the severity of it, and if it meets certain criteria that is outlined in statute, it could be the higher level of a fine. Other licensing violations can either be $100 or $200, depending on the severity of the fine as well. If we're looking at that nature, severity, criticity for all of these violations, it may rise to the level that we say a program needs to be put on a conditional license. Those are typically issued for 2 years, 1 or 2 years, where the conditional license actually outlines terms that the provider would need to come into compliance with in order to keep operating, to come off of that conditional license, and to be into good standing. So these would typically happen if we've seen some repeated kind of chronic violations with a provider that are not, they're not coming into compliance, that if we've seen it more than one time. Or it could be for something that is so severe or so kind of egregious that we would want to do it right away. But the key part of the conditional is that there's actually terms in there that we would say that you need to be in compliance with these. They could be things about additional training, additional supervision, physical plant corrections that need to happen in order to make it safe to do that. During a conditional license period, our licensors actually go out and provide additional monitoring of those programs as well. And so they not only, that's kind of, they get that extra review. So we know that something has risen to a level that requires a conditional, so the licensors go out for the centers at least three additional times that year. And then family child care programs, it can depend a little bit on the licensor in the county, but additional monitoring as well, just to look for terms and if you're in compliance with those. The more serious side of the sanctions that we can impose, one would be a temporary immediate suspension. This is if we are seeing an imminent risk to children that cannot be mitigated immediately. And so we would actually issue a temporary immediate suspension that indicates that the provider needs to stop operating immediately at that point. These are areas where there is that, again, that imminent risk to health and safety for the children that are going on. A lot of times these are paired with an investigation, whether it be a law enforcement investigation or a child maltreatment investigation going on, things like that, that might influence that decision. So those would be kind of that immediately you need to cease operation and then follow through with, there's an appeal process for that and an additional sanction after that that would happen. Sometimes for this next one, for suspensions, we see this when we have, so if we issue that temporary immediate suspension, there's timelines of when this process needs to go, when the appeal happens, how long it can be issued for, and so there's a 90-day limit on those. And what we find is that occasionally there are programs that they're under investigation by law enforcement or by child protection, and that investigation is taking longer than that 90 days. And so we know that that imminent risk still exists because we don't have the results of the investigation. But we don't want the provider's license to go back into good standing and allow them to continue to have access to children and provide that care. So we'd be able to issue that suspension. And then we can revoke a license as well. And so we can issue a revocation. Again, for each of these, we're evaluating that nature, severity, chronicity, and the impact of those violations on the health, safety, and rights of children in care. We also conduct complaint and maltreatment investigations, and this is separate from the licensing kind of annual review process where they're going out and doing that regular monitoring. If there are concerns about licensing violations or alleged maltreatment, abuse, neglect, these get reported in a variety of ways. We have an intake line at DHS that they can report directly to, but sometimes people just report to an official, anybody who happens to, they know. And so it could go to child protection. It could go to county licensing. It could go to a county attorney. And that gets cross-reported to us, and we will accept those reports no matter how they come in, and want to make sure that we're taking a look at those. And so when we receive those reports, we have an initial kind of triage and prioritization that we do on the front end, and then we evaluate for centers. We, our licensors or our maltreatment investigators will follow up on some side of those investigations that need to be taken a deeper look at to see what happened in there. For the counties that do that family child care licensing, they also do the complaint investigations, and child protection does that maltreatment investigation process for them. But the processes and the statute are the same for both the maltreatment of centers and family. And then depending on the outcome of that investigation, we can take any of those previous kind of actions that I had talked about. We could issue correction orders, we could issue a conditional, we could revoke a license. And the fines that are specific to maltreatment as well would apply here. And then all of that information that we do for our compliance monitoring is under those federal CCDF requirements are required to be posted to our public licensing information lookup website. The requirements include that they need to be stated in plain language, posted in a timely manner, and that they're up on that website for at least 3 years in a manner that's accessible and easy for parents to understand. This is meant to kind of give that history of compliance for the program. As parents are looking for care for their children, they can see that and can evaluate what programs they want to look at for their children. In April of 2024, there was a new requirement added to the federal CCDF rule and the final rule that items that are both in compliance and out of compliance have to be posted to the website. So Minnesota and many other states only post those out of compliance items currently. So we have a waiver until August of 2026 and actively working to see what system enhancements need to be made to do that, what processes need to change to do that, and kind of working towards compliance of that as well to make sure that we're in compliance with that. But there'll be some changes to how that looks. And of course, we want to always work with our providers on that as well. That is a page that represents them, so we want their input as we're making changes to this too. Okay, now I'm going to transition to talk about our modernization project a little bit. Also a one that I know a lot of us have heard a lot about recently, and there's been some updates. So I'm happy to be here to kind of talk about those a little bit. This slide just kind of covers the components of this project. I know we've all heard a lot about the revised standards, but there's a couple other components to this project as well that I'm going to talk about. It is for both childcare centers and for family childcare programs. Each of the components are for both of these programs. We're kind of running them simultaneously as two projects together because they are unique, and the providers have different needs, and so we want to make sure that what we're doing is specific to those provider types in there. So the first component of this project that I want to talk about is our weighted risk system. You might hear this referred to as a tiered violation framework or something like that. But really what this is looking at all of those violations and determining, or not violations, all of the standards, excuse me, and determining which ones of these have a higher risk of harm for children versus which ones have little to no risk of harm for children. So on that kind of little to no risk end of things, you'll see things like posting your license in a prominent place. Families have the right to know when I walk in, oh, there's their license. They're licensed by DHS, and so it's a requirement to post that license. But not posting your license does not have an imminent risk of harm to children in care. On the higher end of that, on that level 10 side, you'll see things around like safe sleep for infants that we know can cause harm to children if they are not followed, and some of the improvements that have been made to bring that up to safety. And so those are going to be much more related to the imminent risk area there. So this just kind of gives you a little bit of an overview of how this weighted risk system has broken down for both family child care and child care centers. On that low end, so first, before I do that, to get to this kind of identifying the numbers of where these fell in there, our team held several focus groups to try to first understand kind of what factors do we need to consider in this? And then developed a survey that was sent out to both family childcare and to childcare providers themselves. We had over 1,000 responses for each on this and asked them to kind of wait. Like, what are the most violations that you think are the most important ones for the health and safety of children? And which ones do you think are the least kind of impactful for that? And that was used to formulate this scale here. So you'll see some slight differences for both of these programs because, again, of they're different in how they provide services as well. And so there's naturally going to be a little bit of fluctuation. And the weights were specific from those providers for those programs. So under this system, which has not been implemented yet, but is in process and working towards implementation, on the low end, we have what is called documented technical assistance. This is going to be something very similar to what I was describing with those fix-it tickets, and we'll actually replace the fix-it ticket system and expand it. And so there will be more items that would actually qualify for this. And so licensor goes out, they see a violation. If it falls into this kind of low-risk category, they would get documented technical assistance. We will document it in our checklists. And it will be saved, and then looking again for repeat in the future. And so if you got documented technical assistance 1 year and the same violation happened on that next visit, you probably wouldn't qualify for it to get technical assistance on things. So kind of looking for that. That's why we have it documented. That moderate risk is going to be where those correction orders are issued, and then that higher risk is where some of those licensing actions or those licensing sanctions would fall. And so those were like the fines or a conditional license. That might be somebody not having a background study completed for a staff person, or it might be a safe sleep violation, something like that, that would result in that high risk. The second component to this project is abbreviated inspections. And these are a shortened checklist that can be used with providers if they meet a certain set of criteria. The goal of this is to have providers who have been in, you know, good standing and have had on each of their reviews, there's been little to no violations. There's an abbreviated checklist that could be used then to shorten the amount of time that licensors have to be on site and that providers have to be away from caring for children, to really prioritize having them back in care of children. Some of the categories here that are considered for these abbreviated inspections, they're really based on key indicators, which are created through a methodology and kind of have statistical prediction. If you're in compliance with these sets of standards, you are more than likely in compliance with other ones as well. Like, these are the ones that are predictive of compliance across. This was something that our data team worked with the NARA, the National Association of Regulatory Agencies, who has done a lot of work and research around this area as well, to develop that specific to Minnesota and figure out what those key indicators would be based on our historical licensing data. We also have high-risk rules. So those on that weighted risk side, those high-risk ones, those would be pulled onto an abbreviated inspection checklist, because we want to make sure that we're licensors are going out, they're looking at those high-risk items, because we know that those are going to be the things that are most impactful for the health and safety of children. There's some supplemental items that are pulled onto that checklist. Some of these are things that might have had been kind of right on that line between the high risk and the moderate risk, or they're things that are actual federal requirements that we're required to monitor for as well. And then there's random rules that get pulled into this checklist as well, and just kind of a spot check. And it truly is random, built through our checklist. It kind of pulls in, I think it's 3 or 4 items from that, just kind of randomly. And so the licensors are going out, they're using this, they will be, again, has not been implemented yet, but they would be using this abbreviated checklist. And as they find, I think, yes, on this next slide here, if they find violations through that, the system will actually flip it to a different checklist and kind of go to a more fuller set of standards as well. Because again, as you're looking at those key indicators, if they're out of compliance with some of those items, we know they may be out of compliance with other items too, so the system would actually pull some of those other items onto the checklist. And then the licensor can always pull additional items onto that checklist too, if there is something specific to that program that is unique to that program that they want to monitor, or something that has been historically addressed with that provider. that they could put onto that checklist as well. But the goal of this abbreviated checklist is really trying to reduce the amount of time that that licensing work takes, again, to prioritize having providers spend less time doing that with their licensor and being able to provide care to children. This side kind of talked about a lot in this slide as well, but there's a lot of overlap between these two components here, between our weighted risk system and the abbreviated inspections, and how they interface and feed each other and inform each other in that and how that works in there. Okay, revised licensing standards. I want to talk a little bit about these. This was something that was set up from the Family Child Court Task Force recommendation that originally came out of that. There was a recommendation in there that we should modernize and update licensing standards for family child care rules. And then in 2021, the legislature directed DHS to work with the National Association for Regulatory Administrations to develop revised standards. What's on the slide here is what the legislation said that we needed to work towards, making sure that they were grounded in national regulatory best practices, and that they must protect the health and safety of children and be child-centered, family-friendly, and fair to providers. So our first draft of this was released in April of 2024. Prior to getting that draft released, NARA and our team worked with providers to try to get some ideas and support and input into what those standards were through focus groups, through surveys, through education sessions and outreach. So that input helped put into that first draft. And then when it was released, after that, that is the point that we needed to then engage with providers again, because we want to make sure that we're hitting the right, you know, tone here. And I think we're all aware that we probably didn't hit that right tone in that first draft. We heard a lot from providers that there's a lot of improvement that needs to be made here for this to be successful. And we took that to heart. And we really said that was not our intent. We do not want this to be overly burdensome. We're truly trying to, you know, drive towards those best practices for health and safety of children. And so we then spent, you know, many months engaging with providers in different spaces to get that feedback. You know, what needs to change? How do we improve this? How do we make this right? We held focus groups with county licensors. We participated in over 23 listening sessions across the state in person, inviting providers to come in and provide their feedback on, you know, what is right about this, what needs improvement, what's absolutely not going to work, what is the barrier, wanting to hear directly from them. And then developed a survey as well that anyone sent it to all providers, licensors, any interested parties to fill out as well, and had over 1,600 respondents to that as well, that really kind of went in and asked for a little bit more, like, okay, so if this standard isn't going to work, is it because of cost? Is it because of some kind of other, you know, viability that we're not seeing that's not going to work? Is it because you don't think it's important and it's not going to impact the health and safety of kids and it's just going to be overly burdensome? So really tried to drill down into getting a lot more direct feedback as well from that. And then also did interviews, invited many providers for interviews with Wilder Research to just do some one-on-one. And there were 7 family child care providers and 13 centers that chose to participate in that process. Just to do a one-on-one interview, wanted that to be done. We contracted with Wilder, wanted it to be an external partner that did that as well to try to get some of that feedback that maybe they might have been hesitant to share directly with us. So we did all of that feedback then, and all of that, it was a tremendous amount of information that we received from our providers and licensors, and took that and really worked it into this next draft, which was just released last week on February 13th. Prior to the 13th, we had actually, we released what we called our key themes reports as well, that just highlighted, here are the themes of things that we heard. And we found that providers really did kind of center around very common themes, whether that be environmental standards, supervision, qualifications, and then tried to address, here's how we're going to, what it will look like in the next draft. Then when we published the draft, we also published a document that has, you can see the revisions from draft 1 to 2 in like underline and strikeout language. So it's pretty easy to see in there. Okay, that was where I was concerned in the first one. Here's how it's been addressed in the second one from there. So this was just released last week. Starting next week, we're holding a couple public information sessions for both family child care providers and for child care center providers. And those sessions are just going to be an overview of a little bit of what I've said today, getting a little bit more into the weeds of here are some of the changes that we have seen from there, and then asking everybody who has attended that to fill out a survey as well that can inform what the next level engagement should look like. We certainly have some ideas of how we want to engage with providers, but we want them to help us formulate that strategy as well. Do they want it in person? Do they want it virtual? Do they want webinars that are recorded? You know, what would be the best way to reach out and to get that feedback from them? And then we will continue throughout the summer to engage with providers, with licensors, with anybody who is interested in this to get feedback on this next draft. And, you know, were the changes in the positive direction of, yep, this is more doable, this addressed what my concerns were. Are there some outstanding things that we still didn't quite hit the mark on that we need to continue to work through? Really committed to continuing to engage with the providers and the community on this. Families are welcome to participate as well to make sure we have those voices from everybody in that, to make sure that we're hitting that kind of right balance of making sure that children have access to safe care, that families have access to affordable care, that providers have flexibility and the ability can provide the care that's required of them. That's kind of the theme through everything that we're looking at. How do we do that dance and fit that balance and make it work for everybody in there? So much more of that engagement will be happening this summer, and then that will be informative into the next draft. So there'll be another draft 3 that will be released, and that will actually be after our transition to DCYF, so that will be a DCYF product at that point, but continued work on that. And that will be released prior to the 2026 legislative session, opportunities for stakeholder engagement on that, and then a decision made at that time of the next path forward, whether it would be introduced into the 2026 session or where things would go from there. Okay, next up, I'm gonna cover a little bit of kind of how our licensing division interacts with our program integrity division and does some of this oversight here. So in 2013, DHS had recognized that there was a risk of fraud to our child care assistance program, that CCAP program, and created a CCAP investigations unit at that time. There are some numbers on these slides that kind of just highlight the work that they are doing into investigating this fraud. There's 4 investigators on this team, currently have 62 open cases. Since 2020, this team has recovered about $2.4 million from that CCAP program. And since 2021, they've referred an average of 5 cases to law enforcement each year for criminal investigation and stopped payments to 79 providers. Some averages for the 21 to 24 calendar years here. There's been 43 investigations open, 5 referrals to law enforcement, 17 monetary recovery orders issued, and 5 stopped payments. In that time, so we also stopped CCAP payments to 79 providers and made 18 referrals to law enforcement for criminal investigation. Most of the time, the investigations and these findings are related to an administrative or a compliance issue where we would issue administrative actions. But when we uncover fraud, intentional or criminal actions there, those are the cases that get referred to law enforcement, and that makes up about 20% of the investigations that that unit does. And just a little bit about how our areas interact with licensing. The licensors are often kind of the first eyes on a program. They go out and they are monitoring to kind of look at some of those licensing regulations. but they might see something that looks suspicious of fraud, or they might see something that just doesn't look right in there, whether that be they're not taking attendance records, or they don't have children's records, or the names aren't matching the kids in the program to the records. They would refer those to our CCAP assistance investigators then. And so they would be the ones that would look at those for further deeper to see if there was any kind of fraud intentional or not going on in there. And I wanted to speak a little bit to just kind of that, kind of as we see these licensing regulations or licensing violations, the number itself doesn't tell the whole story. And so we want to make sure that we are looking at, you know, is there a repeated pattern? Are there, you know, additional actions that we can take on the licensing side of things, whether that be a conditional license or a revocation for those repeated patterns? But licensing violations do not always equate to fraud. You know, you can have, like I said, a program that might have a their license isn't posted in a prominent location. That's not necessarily an indication of fraud. Or access to hazardous materials in the program, whether that be the bathroom was in disrepair and the kids had access to a toilet that wasn't flushing. That's not indication of fraud, but it is a licensing violation. So there's kind of a nuance back and forth between these, looking at which ones of these are licensing violations that definitely need to be addressed and programs need to be held accountable and come into compliance with, and which ones do we refer to potential fraud and how those get looked at in those programs as well. Some of these, like I was just talking about, can be indications of both. And so you might see inaccurate attendance records, or they're not keeping attendance records at all. That's definitely a licensing violation and part of our standards, and it is something that could be indicative of fraud that we would refer to the fraud unit to address and with our program integrity staff there too. I think that's my part of it that is done here. I'm going to pass off to my colleague, who is just going to talk a little bit about our background studies process.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Dawn Davis. I am also a Deputy Inspector General with the Background Studies Division. Here this afternoon, thank you for the invitation to present information on background studies. We are the mechanism that interacts and interfaces quite heavily with our licensing division in the Office of Inspector General. And matter of fact, all of our divisions, the Program Integrity Office as well as licensing, have a lot of overlap. This afternoon, I just want to be able to share a few pieces of information about our background studies from sort of that overarching vantage point. So we've got on the first slide a high-level visual representation of DHS's background studies processes that begins for us when providers initiate and submit background study applications into our Net Study 2 system. And with all of the active provider types for DHS's statewide background study system, there are over 70 different provider types that we perform studies for, with an active provider base of in Net Study 2 as 72,000. So study subjects receive and complete an electronic consent and disclosure form. They submit that in the system and then also have 14 days by which to move forward in the process with IDEMIA, the fingerprint vendor, to actually select a location that is closest to them. DHS then receives and reviews criminal history and maltreatment records and may need to obtain additional records from other registries or repositories that include, in some cases, other states. And DHS does make a determination of eligibility for most background studies, and then notices are then mailed out to the individual study subject, as well the provider actually has access to that information, the determination in the Net Study 2 system. And then can we click to the next slide? For the federal authority with the CCDBG, as Alyssa had shared, the Child Care Development Block Grant Act, in 2014 also began to require states and territories to have, in effect, requirements and processes as well as procedures to conduct background checks for all child care staff members, including those who are prospective staff members of all child care centers, including those affiliated with the child care provider's licensure. Those programs include licensed and regulated or registered under state and territory law, as well as all other providers eligible to deliver the Child Care Development Fund services, which would include license-exempt Child Care Development Fund eligible providers. I would also like to just mention, in addition to this slide with the federal authorities, that DHS, since 2018, October 4th, actually, we launched the statewide enhanced child care studies, background studies effort, and have been operating in that effort since that time. And DHS continues to cover the cost of the applications as well as the fingerprinting services for all child care study subjects. All right. You can reach the next slide. Okay, thank you. So with the background check components under the Child Care Development Block Grant, they are probably the most rigorous that we have in all of the different study types that we perform studies for other state agencies and regulated provider types. With the background check components for the Child Care Development Block Grant, there's a comprehensive child criminal background check is required for providers that are newly affiliated individuals and household members of a child care provider's license. This includes adults where there are three in-state background checks, two national background checks, and three interstate background checks that we have to perform. In addition, for minors, we also conduct checks that are name and date of birth for criminal history, predatory offender, and maltreatment, which are required for those minors who are living in a household where there are licensed programs that are or services that are being provided with the age of 10 to 12, when there is reasonable cause, and then also 13 and older. So we do conduct some studies for minors as well as required by the federal authority. For the disqualification process, I'd like to share with you all that for the question that I think was posed to us was, what information disqualifies individuals from working in a child care center? And that information can be found as a list of disqualifying crimes and conduct in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 245C15. But some examples that we have to be able to share with you today are disqualifying offenses for child care are maltreatment, physical assault, murder, criminal sexual conduct, and theft. Most disqualifications are also limited by time, by tiers in time. So 15 years, 10 years, 7 years, or 5 years. And some are often permanent. And in addition, I just want to share, as we move to the last slide, I have some data to share with you in regard to our background studies applications that we've received for calendar year 2024. Although we're still working to finish our closeout with our data analytics and insights team, the initial information that we have to share is that DHS's statewide background study conducted 538,000 background study applications that were received in calendar year 2024. Of those, 73,556, or 14%, were from all child care providers. And that concludes my information today.
Thank you for your presentation. We will now move to member questions. That did take a considerable amount of time, so you answered several questions that I had, so I'll keep my questions a little more brief so that other members of the committee have their opportunity to ask their questions. A question I have is, when a center... So like a center that receives CCAP funds and in an investigation they discover violation, particularly like maltreatment violations, that's what's of great concern to me. When those violations occur, what conditions are there that stop funding immediately Or is that a, just a case-by-case basis, or is it something that is cut and dry for the enforcement people?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, there's not a, the licensing regulation violations, the authority to stop payments, it's not a direct, if there's violations, then these types of violations result in a stop payment. There's no authority to just stop payment for those licensing violations in general or maltreatment. Those are things that we would, they have to be indicative of fraud in the program or things that the that CCAP investigations unit would be looking at for indicative fraud in order to be able to issue a stop payment for those programs.
Thank you for the answer. That's one thing that's been troubling is, so in the case of many families, they're presented with the situation of where they were paying for their children to be abused. And I think of that from the tax dollars and the taxpayers' perspective is you don't want to provide assistance to an area where abuse may be occurring. So we might look at that later. You answered the question on whether site visits are announced or unannounced. What's interesting is I've heard conflicting information, but now I've heard consistently that they are unannounced, which obviously for an enforcement mechanism, that is exactly what would go. So one question, that's just a comment. One question I have is when we don't have mandated electronic attendance reporting for fraud purposes right now, that is something that the many from both parties have supported moving towards. So when it's not electronic attendance, How do you verify that these children, I mean, honestly exist? We've seen children who don't exist being reimbursed. How do you verify that they exist, and is there any auditing when it's a non-electronic form of attendance records? Ms. Dawson.
Yes, thank you. I can speak a little bit from the licensing perspective of what our licensors do. Unfortunately, I don't have our program integrity staff here today to be able to go deeper into how they do that, but I know when our licensor is on site, they're looking at the attendance records and talking to the children. Sometimes the children are the ones that are able to share, that's not my name, that's my name, that's who that person is. And so they talk to the children and they verify what children are in care. They look to see whose record, they make sure they have records there, and they're verifying that those children, as they're on site, are the ones that are in care. And if they see discrepancies in that, that's where they're referring it to our program integrity division. And I, like I said, I don't know if there's, you have insight into that, but we can get some follow up for the what the program integrity investigators do and how they verify that. Unfortunately, there's not somebody here to support that today.
Yeah, that would be very valuable for the committee. Yeah. I mean, I love my little girl and I love 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds, but I don't consider them credible sources of information, unfortunately. and this is going to be my last question because I don't want to hog all the time for our committee members. When a maltreatment all violations are end up public data, as far as I can tell. You can look it up and find it on the licensing website. When specifically, like a maltreatment violation is reported, are parents notified, or do they have to go on the website to be notified?
Thank you for the question. Yes. So, if the parent, the parents of the alleged victim, the children or victims, the ones that are alleged to be involved in the incident, are notified by our investigators when we open an investigation. And so the investigator would call them, let them know this is the incident that had been reported, and talk to them and get more information from the parents' perspective on that. At the end, in the completion of an investigation, there's a requirement to do a notification if maltreatment has been determined to all parents that were either in the area where the maltreatment occurred, or if it is a more broad kind of widespread issue that happened across the facility, then to all parents of that as well. So they would get notification saying that maltreatment has been determined, and then they can go to the licensing lookup website to see the report. There's a public report that's completed as well of the summary of the investigation.
Thank you, Ms. Dodson. Chair Watum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My microphone's off. Thank you for being here with us today. This is a really informative overview, and I think, you know, we'll have additional conversations on different parts of the presentation as the session continues. I have two quick questions, or on background checks and fingerprinting specifically, and then I have another question, Mr. Chair. So when these portions move over in June to the new department, DCYF, will the background checks and fingerprinting still remain within DHS? Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Ms. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Yes, we are working on a plan for that, for background checks, background studies to remain at DHS. We're in the throes of that with the BCA and have inquiry into the FBI right now.
Chair Witu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then that's really helpful. I mean, I think that because there are so many programs that do require these background screens, it probably makes sense not to section them off into the new department. And I know we've had, particularly with Representative Zalesnikar and Representative Keeler in years past, conversation on just the process and how long it takes and how folks can access fingerprinting opportunities that are nearest to their home and that sort of thing. And it does impact so many of our human services programs as well. But I heard you say that since 2018, DHS has been covering the costs of fingerprinting and background screens. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. So that is incredible. It's something that I think that I knew about on some level, but it just feels like that's a very real savings to small business owners that the state has helped them cover over the last 6 years or so. So I think that that's tremendous. I mean, being able to recruit, hire, train, all of those costs really add up. And we know that there is a challenge in turnover in this industry because of a variety of reasons. But that I think that that's a really great example of one of the ways that the state can continue to support childcare providers. I'm hoping that potentially Ms. Dotson, you could clarify a little bit further the difference between some of these administrative violations and errors. We had Commissioner Brown in last week, and she was giving us a little bit of a higher level overview of the transition into DCYF. But there's a lot of conversation and necessarily so, right, about preventing waste, fraud, and error. But what I was hearing you say is kind of the timeline between when an administrative error is caught in some of these license visits, but then at what point do they get referred to a CCAP investigation, and then at what point payment would actually be stopped to that provider. I'm just kind of hoping you can give us a little bit more clarity between CCAP fraud, which is a phrase that's thrown around really a lot. It's been in the news a little bit recently, and to me, it wasn't seeming like there was actually cases of CCAP fraud. The media sometimes runs away with these ideas, and that we're doing everything that we can in our power to make sure that things don't reach that that point.
Ms. Dotson.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. So I can speak a little bit. Again, program integrity is not my deep wheelhouse of information, but like you said, there is this interplay between licensing and the work that our licensors do and the program integrity. So if the licensors are on site and they see something that would be indicative of fraud, they do a referral immediately to our program integrity. They don't wait for the completion of their review or their investigation. It's more than likely the same day or the next day, depending on the time of the visit, that they do that referral. And then our program integrity division has their own intake process that they review those complaints as well and determine if there is further investigation needed or what action they would take from there. Those investigations can take a variety of timelines depending on what factors there are. Each investigation is going to be nuanced and complex to the situation at hand. Is it a small provider with a few children in care, or is it a large provider with multiple locations and hundreds of children in care in there? Those are going to take different timelines to go through in there. There's different actions that the program integrity unit can take when they're identifying at different points. If there's a credible allegation of fraud, they do have the ability to issue a payment withhold at that point. But as I was talking about in the slides, there's you know, about 20% of our investigations on that program integrity side are indicative of criminal or intentional fraud. A lot of this investigations that they do, that other 80%, is made up of those more administrative or errors or some of that misunderstanding or education that could be provided. It is still billing incorrectly, but it wasn't done with, you know, a criminal intent in there and trying to hide it. You know, the provider is coming forward and engaging in the investigation and saying, you know, here's what I did, here's what I thought I was doing right. There may still be a monetary recovery that is needed because it was billed incorrectly, but it wasn't a criminal intent in that process.
Chair Katizuatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. That's really, I think, really helpful. We all know that fraud against the government particularly is not a victimless crime. I mean, these are taxpayer dollars that we want to be spent as efficiently and as effectively as possible. But I think that, you know, particularly in these cases, in the case of CCAP and in the case of, you know, other similar programs, it's the impact is on children and families, right? So if our knee-jerk reaction is to claw back funding, stop all CCAP payments to a provider, whether it was a maltreatment situation or if there's these credible allegations of fraud, it's the families, it's our littlest learners who are impacted by this. So I think that having the system in place that can be systematic and step by step instead of just, you know, more of a knee-jerk reaction, like I said, I think that really helps us to get to the bottom of it as quickly as possible. I think that it's really important that we're having this conversation. So appreciate you giving us all the background information that we need, and I'm sure you'll be able to assist us as we move forward and continue implementing these program integrity measures this session.
Representative McDonald and then Representative Coulter.
Mr. Chair, thank you. See, in regards to your PowerPoint slide on page 10 on our paper here. It's under DHS is interested in exploring other child care models to address the state's need for child care. I don't know if you touched on that specifically, but as you know, we're one of the most expensive in the nation. We have some of the highest regulations and mandates on our child care facilities. We do have the reputation and the history of having one of the most safe child care centers, and that's good to be proud of. But other states that are surrounding us are significantly less, and their records indicate their children are pretty safe as well. KSTP's recent news report that we aren't the, you know, our facilities aren't the most safe. There are some violations. There's 62 investigations now. So the question for you is, what other exploring are you doing to surrounding states that you can help us as lawmakers with legislation to put into law that can reduce the cost of child care, not throwing more money at it, because we don't have any. We're, you know, looming $5.2 billion deficit in a couple of years. Besides putting more mandates on and more money, what can we do to reduce the cost, reduce the regulations, and make it more affordable yet still safe for facilities around the state, especially rural Minnesota?
Ms. Dotson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald for the question. So, one model that we currently have existing in statute right now that has been, in some lanes, has been a little difficult to implement and could use some work to expand is what we call special family child care. It's kind of a bit of a misnomer in how it's named, but special family child care. This allows for some of those programs to operate with kind of under one organization but separate programs. So these are run in like a church or maybe a school. They can have four family child care programs under one contiguous roof. The programs need to operate separately, but they can have kind of one organizational oversight. That brings some efficiency to it. It might bring some resource cost sharing to it if they're sharing a building. This has been a model that a lot of our family child care providers have been exploring recently as well, as saying that could be something that could be more cost efficient and be a way to still provide that small model care. And that slide specifically was referencing the alternate licensing report that was done by Wilder Research a few years ago, and we can make sure that you have access to that report. If you don't, it is on our website. And that really did compare to those other states. What are other states doing? I mean, I think that's a question that we all want to know. What are other states doing? We're not unique. We're not the only state providing childcare. Are there successes in other states? Are there other states that are doing this in a way that is more financially viable for providers? Let's learn from them and not recreate. And so this report tried to look at some of those models of what are other states doing and found a couple avenues of looking at really trying to build towards that kind of resource sharing. There can be a huge cost to running a business out of your home if you're doing it on your own. And family child care providers are typically a single provider, one person operating a business out of their home, which can be really burdensome. So is there a way to do kind of a mixed model approach, to do kind of, I think, what they called like an umbrella approach where you could have some more resource sharing? Is there a way to expand this smaller programming out into the community outside of a person's own home? I think that, you know, recently the trends are more towards, you know, there's privacy and people want privacy in their own home. They don't want to run a business out of their own home. Or there's younger individuals who don't own a home. And then there's maybe some limitations on in rental areas and whether your landlord's going to let you run a business out of your home. So I think that report is really helpful and could be a really good starting place to kind of look at, do that comparison to what other states are doing, and is there an avenue to kind of explore this here in Minnesota and what we can do to support.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it looks like
pretty
we got
quickly because we have a few other
Mr.
members.
Chair? Yeah. Oh, no, I'm closing. This is my closing argument here. Looks like we have some work to do, and that's a, you know, we'll work with you if you'll work with us. And then lastly, do you think it would be prudent for this committee to perhaps put legislation down and support the ratios? You know, Minnesota's 4-1, other states are 10-1. That's probably too high, in my opinion. But maybe if we change it to a 6-1, perhaps, do you think that would be prudent? It certainly would lower the cost of health of the child care and allow it more availability for especially rural Minnesota. What's your thoughts on that? And I'll close, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. I think it's a worthy conversation to have. And our draft standards did address some of the capacity and ratios, and there's some movement in there, that area. I think anytime that we're looking at ratios, we just want to make sure that we're hitting that balance right. Is it still feasible to protect the safety of children and making sure that providers have can, you know, address the needs of the children and have the space to address the needs of the children in doing that. And so there's just kind of that balance to do there. Definitely, it is an ongoing conversation that we have heard from providers, from licensors, from many people of just looking at that. And I think in our draft standards, we address it a little bit. And then, always happy to engage in the conversation and trying to strike that right balance.
Thank you, Ms. Dodson. We definitely don't have time for everybody on the list, but what I want to say to everyone who is on the list that we may not get to, we will submit, because I know you want to answer our questions, so please submit your questions and please send back the answer to those questions to the entire committee. Because I feel like there's going to be many more, if you'd like, you can always ask yourselves as individual members, but I'm happy to consolidate everybody's questions and send it to them in one lump sum so we can get it out of the committee. Apologize for my poor time management. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I will limit it to to one of the questions that I had written down, because the conversations that I've had with providers, and I've been all over the state. I was up in Mountain Iron, in New Ulm, in St. Paul, and in my district not too long ago. It never seems to me to come down to sort of the number of regulations so much as it is how are they interpreted, how are they enforced. And, particularly when we're talking about family child care providers, because we're talking about licensors at the county level, I mean, it's tough enough, I would imagine, even with everybody working for DHS. But now suddenly you have 87 different agencies that these folks all work for. That there is concern about that sort of consistency of interpretation. So I'm wondering if you could just sort of speak to a little bit about, you know, how is that, how do you address that issue? Is there an internal process? Like, how do we make sure that somebody in, just to pick a random example, Wright County is enforcing things the same way they would just across the border in Hennepin County?
Ms. Dodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter. You're right, that is a challenge, especially in a county delegated system when there's licensors in multiple different counties, and it's a challenge that we hear from providers is that there's some inconsistency in there. Currently, there's a few ways that we try to address this. Our family child care unit at DHS provides a lot of triage and technical assistance to licensors. Licensors routinely call in and say, hey, here's what I observed. Do you think this is a violation? Is it not? We try to drive that consistency from our side of the of kind of that statewide look at all of the programs and the regulations, providing that kind of technical assistance to the licensors. There is also a specific to family child care providers, there's a dispute process that is actually prior to a correction order being issued. The licensors are required to do an exit interview at the end of their reviews and say, here's all what my findings are going to be. Here is, you know, where we are. It allows the provider an opportunity to provide additional evidence maybe at that point and say, oh, no, no, I actually have that paperwork. It just wasn't in the right file. It's right here. And then it wouldn't be a violation. But if a violation, they don't have that, they can actually, what we call dispute it, and it goes to us at DHS then to kind of review the evidence and say, is there enough for a violation here or not? And then it also goes through a reconsideration process that kind of looks for that consistency as well. That being said, I understand that that's still not, you know, perfect, and it still is not addressing some of those inconsistencies that exist. So one thing that we are committed to doing with the draft standards as they are being released and kind of working through once it gets through legislative session is creating what we call interpretive guidelines around those. And so that you can really get into, here's what the standard says. Here's the plain language interpretation of what that standard means and what you would need to do to be in compliance with it. And really using those interpretive guidelines then to drive consistency so that providers have access to it, families have access to it, licensors have access to it, and everybody is interpreting those in generally the same way. We have chosen not to do that right now since standards are likely changing in there, and that is a very resource-intense process, so we're continuing to just engage with licensors in our current kind of training and education and triage and technical assistance that we do with them right now.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Just one very quick follow-up question. How frequently does DHS override county action recommendations?
Ms. Dodson.
Thank you. I don't have specific off the top of my head, but it's not very frequent. We really do try to work with counties to, if they've submitted a recommendation to us and we're not quite seeing it, we're not agreeing on what the action would be, we try to work with them and say, hey, can we get a little bit more information about this? Can we get some, can you reach out to the provider? We need more evidence. Is there any pictures that can show us that might demonstrate this? And work to come to agreement in there. So it's fairly rare that we would override a decision without agreement with the county. We really try to just work with them because sometimes there might be a new licensor that just submits a recommendation that's pretty bare bones. And so we would call them and say, okay, let's talk this one through and really try to partner and work with them.
Representative Cole.
I can see we're at the buzzer, so I'll be done. Thank you.
All right. We have 2 minutes left. Lightning round? Or is it? Deeper. All right. Representative Nadeau, we'll try and get Representative Nadeau one more. Lightning round for everyone, please.
I have so many questions, but I will focus on thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will follow up. But I love quickly, I love the idea that you guys are looking at being more flexible. DHS doesn't have the reputation of being flexible. Just hearing about dual licensure is a wonderful thing. That doesn't happen in the disabled community, and we've been trying to work on those things for a while. So hopefully DCYF will be a lot more open. My question has to do with the number of providers that are dropping. Have you guys done, do you plan to, would you be willing to do almost like exit interviews? Why are so many people stopping? How many people have had how many organizations, providers have had significant license issues, for example? Are they leaving because they can't meet the licensure requirements? So I'll leave it at that just and quickly. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dodson, more lightning than that.
I'll go quick. Yeah, we don't currently collect that data, but we are exploring ways to collect that in the future, because I think that is really valuable information to have so that we can actually hear from providers from them directly what is it that is driving you to close your license, and so that we make sure that we are putting solutions in place that are actually addressing what the problems might be. So, yes, we are researching it. We don't have it right now. It will take systems work. It will take working with our county partners to get that, as those are county delegated. And so as we are making systems improvements, we are building it into that.
To make sure we have a balanced members of each party not heard, we will have Representative Hemmings and Yeager will lightning it out, and then we will be done.
Got it. Thanks. Okay, so last week I asked DCYF about the cases that get referred to law enforcement, and I appreciate on slide 32, you said that 5 cases have been referred in last since 2021. How many of those went to the counties? How many of those went to the BCA? And then of those, how many are resolved?
Oh, new person.
What? Mr. Chair, Christy Grum, I'm the Director of State Government Relations at DHS. Representative, I apologize, I don't have that in. I can follow up with you.
Well, that was lightning, and that was that was true lightning. Now, Representative Nadeau, you could probably. All right. Thank you for. We will definitely be loading you up with questions that you'll have time to answer, because they'll be in written form. But there are a lot more that was not asked because of time limitations today. So, get ready. Thank you for coming before the committee.
Thank you so much.
Adjourned.
Thank you.